Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in basically researching hallucinogens as medicine.
Well, I mean, this is an area that was actually at some time ago in the 50s and early mid-60s was one of the leading cutting-edge research areas in psychiatry. And it was only after the cultural turmoil of the late 60s that that this area was abandoned. When I decided to go to medical school and become a physician and then become a psychiatrist, I had an opportunity to read much of the old literature, and I was very impressed with the as yet untapped potentials this research model held for understanding the brain, the mind-brain interface, understanding mental illness, and perhaps giving us some new paths to explore, new and innovative treatment models.
And Dr. Schlitz, your involvement and interest.
Well, the Institute of Noetic Sciences has long been interested in consciousness and understanding the potentials of our consciousness. And one of the things that we have been particularly tracking is the way in which people hold models of reality. And so there are many triggers that can open us to a broader sense of reality. And one of those triggers is psychedelics. Another is, you know, a trip to the moon like Edgar Mitchell. In each case, I think what's revealed is that there are a broader set of possibilities. The kind of work that Dr. Grobe is doing, I think, reveals the potential of using something like psilocybin, you know, the magic mushroom.
Magic mushroom, sure.
As a way of really working with terminally ill patients who are hungry for a more expanded meaning system and really looking for quality of life at the end of life. And so I see that, you know, it's about expanding our model of reality as well as providing therapeutic tools that will help people when they're facing life-threatening situations.
But you're not advocating that people go to their nearest forest and dig up these magic mushrooms if they can find them and gobble them up, are you?
No, absolutely not. I think most of the teachers that we've worked with who have done research on psychedelics, on hallucinogens, advocate that it should be done under very well-controlled circumstances with, you know, somebody trained to guide you. It's not recreational. It's ceremonial. And it does have a really profound sort of spiritual or even religious potential to help, you know, inspire a broader sense of what our human possibility is.
Well, you know, almost since the beginning of mankind, shamans, Dr. Grobe and Dr. Schlitz, shamans have used these hallucinogens in different forms, magic mushrooms, of course, to truly do incredible things with the mind. I mean, they have been able to travel out of their bodies, heal people, and we're talking about events that are thousands of years old.
Well, absolutely. I mean, these are the ancient models of healing. These were the ancient medicine men and women who were able to tap into the innate healing potentialities of many plants. And I think there's much to be learned. Unfortunately, with the with the rapid disappearance of indigenous pre-industrial shamanic societies, much of this knowledge is no longer accessible. But to the degree that we have acquired information, clearly these ancients, these so-called primitives, who are not so primitive at all, have much to teach us.
How did they get so advanced? I mean, you're right. They do teach us. When we look at how the Mayans were able to develop their calendars and astronomy, I mean, we all sit back going, how did they know this so long ago? In this particular case, with the use of hallucinogens as medicine and as mood and mind altering, how did they know these? And we're just starting to find out.
Oh, we're just starting to scratch the surface. Keep in mind that the ancient peoples had opportunity to systematically, methodically explore the range of effects of hallucinogens, from generation to generation to generation, going on for for the anthropologist tell us for tens of thousands of years. And here we're just rediscovering that these substances even exist at all. In fact, it wasn't until the second half of the 20th century that we became even aware that plant hallucinogens like the hallucinogenic mushroom was a real phenomenon instead of mythological.
Because some of these hallucinogens are considered illegal by our government, is that one of the reasons why science has decided in those days really not to look into it, not to investigate this?
Well, I think there's, of course, the legality has made it very problematic in terms of opening this up for investigation, but you know, I think there was a tendency in our culture to disparage any knowledge or information systems derived from the indigenous peoples. So I think it's only at the point at which we have evolved as a culture that we begin to appreciate the exquisite sensitivity that the that native peoples did have to understanding these compounds and the states of mind they induced.
Now, Marilyn, these psychedelics, do they induce something in the brain that might not ever get induced, or is it possible that we human beings can perform these incredible feats without the use of hallucinogens?
Well, it certainly stimulates certain kind of neurochemicals in the brain that our brain naturally produces, but can provide sort of a more intense connection to those states of consciousness. I wanted to go back to your question about indigenous peoples and say that not only is this in the past that people who live, you know, in nature have utilized these practices, you know, through trial and error over thousands of years, as Dr. Grobe mentioned, but I've had the privilege over the last 10 years to work with the Achuar people of the Ecuadorian Amazon. And that's a group that use plant medicines, as they are known, as well as using their nighttime sleeping practices to gain information about realms of reality that mm-hmm. aren't always available during kind of our mundane experiences. So they do something called a collective dreaming practice, where every morning, kind of pre-dawn, they wake up and they believe that it's their responsibility to share the content of their dreams with one another. And the reason for this is that they believe that the soul or the non-tangible aspects of our experience leave the body during sleep and travel through the forest and into the spirit realm. And just in the same way that we might wake up in the morning and read a newspaper to find out what's been happening in the world, they actually believe that the soul goes out, gains reliable information about the future, and then they come back with the notion that nobody gets the whole story, but that each of them has a piece of it. So by doing this dream sharing, they believe that they get reliable information about what to do today and what to do tomorrow. For example, will they be visited? Will the visitors be friendly? Should they hunt? Will the hunt be successful? But if they want a big dream, if they want to know something long-term in the future, they'll make use of different kinds of plant medicines. For example, ayahuasca, which is a hallucinogen that evokes visions.
Right.
And they use these visions as a way of predicting what will happen, you know, a long time in the future.